Chevy Equinox with forward collision alert, automatic emergency braking, and available all-wheel drive. It's my ultimate mobile device. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule a test drive. Chevy Equinox. It's your choice. Own it.
WGN and a happy Saturday evening to you. Thank you so much for listening. Normally, this is the Nocturnal Journal with David Hoekstra. He's not in tonight. Myself, John Hanson, going to be filling in for the next 2 hours till 11 o'clock before Lisa and Carl get in. Thank you so much for listening on this rather dreary, spooky Saturday evening, late April snow showers. We're going to find out just how historic this is, because it really is historic to be getting this much snowfall this late in the season. Mike Jansen from good old Channel 9 is going to join us in the next hour to chat through that. But I got to say a pleasant good evening to Ro Coleman. Ro, you are a hardworking woman. How you doing, Ro?
I'm fantabulous. Thank you so much.
Fantabulous. I like that. You were producing for Amy and you're carrying right on over here. Now, you were expected to be off tonight because of the White Sox, right? Or do you normally do for David here 9 to 11?
I'm normally for David most recently. So I wasn't going to be here regardless.
You were going to be here no matter what. So it wasn't a change for you. What do you think about the snow? You feeling okay about this?
I'm upset. Yesterday was so nice. See this little jacket I have?
Cute jacket.
Thank you, but I wasn't prepared. It's freezing outside now.
I think I cursed us. Because about after the last storm we had a couple weeks ago, the one two Sundays ago, I thought, okay, well, that's got to be it. And I went ahead and put the heavy jacket away into a secondary closet, almost put it down to storage.
Oh, John.
I know. And I put the winter gloves, the scarves, everything in a little garbage bag to put in a corner somewhere, hidden away back in a closet, thinking there's no way we're going to need them again. So it's my fault.
It's your fault.
My fault. Chicago can blame me. Also joining us in studio, Curtis Koch, who I think just by default, one should assume that you're in this building. You practically live here.
At some point during the day, yeah. I've been here since 9 this morning. I was here producing Frank Fontana.
Mm-hmm.
And then with Amy as well for the business lunch, mm-hmm. I basically filled in for Griffin, who is normally producing those
with
shows.
With John Williams, yeah.
And hoping that the White Sox would play.
Right. I don't know what made you think they would.
But if they would have played, I would have maybe gone home, changed, had a home-cooked meal, then came back here for Dave Plyer. But since that's not the case, I was still here regardless for White Sox Weekly and then The Beat. Now I'm just hanging out.
You're going to be here till 5 a.m.?
Yes.
Because you're in for Plyer, or you're with Plyer, obviously.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to do some quick math. That's 20 straight hours.
Just about. Yeah.
Just about 20 straight hours for Curtis.
Although, after our little segment here, I'll leave and grab some dinner and get some fresh air so I'm not inside a building for those 20 hours or
good.
So.
Yeah, because I figured that's kind of cruel of me to ask you to work a little bit harder here. I know you were busy helping out at getting Dave's show ready. What do you got coming up on with Plyer,
by the
way?
Oh, gosh. So it's the 45th anniversary of Happy Days. So Dave's got a bunch of guests lined up
for
that,
Of course he does.
Later on in the show, we're going to be replaying an interview he did with Marion Ross. But we're also going to have Anson Williams in studio. And we're also going to have Henry Winkler on the phone. But
jeez.
Before all of that, we're actually going to talk, and John, you'll like this. We're going to be talking to the author of a new book about Harry Carey. The book's called The Legendary Harry Carey, Baseball's Greatest Salesman. So we're going to be talking to him about the book, sharing some stories about Harry Carey and all of that, too, coming up at 2 o'clock.
I was going to say, that's 5 hours away. This is quite a tease, everyone.
Yeah.
So you're in for a nice long night. That's fun. But let's get things started with a little fun of our own. When I fill in, I like to play a little game called Finish the Headlines. We got a little music queued up for that. And the rules are pretty simple. So away we go with the music. And, Ro, have you ever played this game with me? Or
I haven't.
I don't think so. You've been with me a couple times. I don't think we played this game. Probably had other better things to do. But here's the way it works. I'll just read a simple story, a news story. It has a twist at the end. And you've got to guess the twist. So give us a call, 312-981-7200. You can call us, or you can text us if you think to know the answer. And, Ro, I want you jumping in as well. And, of course, Curtis as well. And then David Jennings, when he gets back in the newsroom, he can also jump on in as well. He's busy preparing the next report. A lot going on in the news and weather today. All right, where should I start? Do we want to start in the UK or do we want to start in Brazil? Where do you want to go first?
Let's go to Brazil.
Let's go to Brazil. Okay. An arrest has been made in Brazil tied to drug dealers in Brazil, but someone or something very unusual has been taken into custody following a raid targeting crack dealers. That's your first hint. Not really a hint. That's how the story goes. So they made an arrest of drug dealers, and there's something unusual they also brought into custody that was helping them make these drug deals. Any questions? Any ideas?
Fruit.
Okay. No, it's not fruit, but I could see maybe they want all the substances, or maybe, did you think maybe they were hiding some
stuff? Yeah, like they're stuffing them, kind of.
Nope, nothing stuffed in fruit. Well, I don't know for sure, but that's not what they brought into custody. Curtis, any early guesses?
You know, Brazil is right in the mix of the jungles there. Is it some sort of animal?
It is an animal. Yes, they have brought an animal in.
A cheetah?
Not a cheetah. That would be quite something. That's a good, if you're gonna move drugs, slap it on a cheetah's back. That thing can fly pretty quickly. And by fly, I mean, you know, across the ground.
A bird?
You're close. Give us the specific kind.
Not a cockatoo, not a toucan.
Any guesses?
Is it a bird that speaks?
It is a bird that speaks, and that limits us, David.
A parakeet?
It is not a parakeet. It's a parrot! Yes, David Jennings has gotten it. A parrot taken into custody following a police raid in Brazil. According to the press, the bird had been taught to alert criminals to police operations. It would say, "Mum the police," when police were anywhere nearby. This is from The Guardian. The parrot, who has not been named, was no age either on that. They can live a long time, those parrots.
They can. Yeah.
I know people
What, 70 or 80 years?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think some have gotten to the century mark. Don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure that they get up there, certainly. I know I've heard stories of people buying a parrot expecting them to live 5 or 6 years, and they're like, this thing's been with us for generations. But the officer says they were trained for it, and they brought the parrot in. And right now, and they do say, they brought the parrot into the police station. It was making all the noise when they arrived, and guess what? Now it's gone silent. So they've really
imagine why.
Really trained that thing not to divulge.
Too many of them.
Yes. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break, then a couple more headlines here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, a happy Saturday evening to you, everyone. John Hanson in for the next 2 hours, or just less than that, to 11 o'clock today, in for the Nocturnal Journal with David Hoekstra. He's out tonight, but I got a cast of characters along with me, as always. Ro Coleman, producing behind the mic, doing well there. She's chiming in as well. And we got Curtis Koch stepping in, the man who's working in the middle of a 20-hour work shift, essentially. I don't know if you're getting paid for all of it.
He's young. No. Yeah, he hasn't learned yet.
He will eventually.
We've all been down this road. It's like, yeah, okay.
It's like a rite of passage.
Yeah, it is a rite. It absolutely is a rite of passage.
It's a rite of
radio.
Torture.
You'd do it again, though, right, David? Okay, we're playing finished the headlines here, where I give you some of the news headlines you probably won't hear in the David Jennings reports, and then you've got to guess what the end of the headline is. If you want to play along, we'd love to have you, and any conversation you want to join us in, 312-981-7200, and you can call us on the phone, or you can text us on in if you've got some answers or want to chime in any way. Are we all ready for the next one?
Yes.
All right, so do we want to go to the UK or New Hampshire?
Let's do UK.
All right, let's go to the UK here. Okay. UK employers may be banning something that's done pretty much every single day in every workplace across the country and across the world. Something that might seem harmless enough, but they're going to ban it, or they're considering banning it in certain companies in the UK.
Drinking.
What's that?
Drinking.
Right, yeah. I wish. I mean, I love when they talk about office parties. Back in the day, and David, you were in radio for many, many years. Used to be a much more fun environment, less corporate in the newsrooms, right?
It was just less corporate, period.
Yeah.
You could smoke at your desk.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Like in the newsroom?
Yes.
Wow. Was it encouraged?
It's just a matter. It just was.
Yeah.
It's like you smoked at your desk at work.
Wow.
Everyone did in the office.
Yeah.
It wasn't for those who smoked. It was no big deal.
I mean, I remember people smoking on airplanes, so I guess that's not too far-fetched. Probably a lot safer just to do it in your office.
People used to smoke on buses interstate buses anyway, I
think.
That's
crazy. Oh, I'm sure. You know, it's amazing because I remember when they the Illinois Smoking Ordinance of 2005 or the Clean Air Ordinance in 2005, I was in college at the time, and I remember thinking, oh, man, that's going to be so weird not having people smoke in the bars with you or in the restaurants. And, I mean, nowadays, you don't even think about it. If someone lights up, it's such an unusual thing inside. But just to fathom smoking inside airplanes and all that sort of stuff. Anyways, nope, it is not drinking. It's also not smoking. Something pretty usual, but HR people are a little worried about it.
Donuts.
Now, that's something that's good, especially around here. Man, you can never walk into this building without a load of candy or breakfast treats or steaks because Pete McMurray knows the guy from Weber.
It's really ugly between Christmas and Thanksgiving and New Year's.
I thank this place for the recent 10 pounds I've put on.
Well, so. Yeah, and I know people are rolling their eyes.
Don't blame us. You didn't have to pick it up.
Don't blame us. Blame Roger Badish, who used to stuff me with a
stuff up, so it's like, yeah, okay.
It's true. And those red vines that are out there sometimes.
Oh, I hate those things.
Oh, well, I still eat them.
Candy and I are not big fans of each other.
Right. It's all the pastries. I'm a sucker for all the pastries that come through here.
I know, and I'm very thankful for everyone who drops them off and picks them up, and it's a business. You need sometimes some extra sugar to get through. I know people are probably not sympathetic at all to the cause, but I've never seen a place with more candy. No, it's not candy. Great guess, though, Ro. Curtis, any guesses what they've banned from the workplace? Or what they're thinking about banning, I should say, in the UK?
I was thinking vending machines.
That's another good guess. It has nothing to do with eating, drinking, consuming, anything.
Is it about interaction between people?
Yeah, you're thinking there. So HR is
no involved. Hugging.
No more handshakes?
No more hugging.
Hugging is a great guess, but it's handshakes. Ro has got it. It may seem harmless enough, but handshakes in the workplace could soon become a thing of the past under a new physical contact rule being considered in the UK, according to human resource experts. So they said employers just may enact a complete ban on any physical contact, including handshakes, in order to avoid expensive sexual harassment suits. This is just crazy. I know, I'm all about Me Too. I'm all about, you know, respecting everyone, man, woman, doesn't matter, in the workplace. But the handshake, come on, people.
I was thinking more along the lines of like a health sort of thing.
Right.
Because you think about, like, you know, people go to the bathroom. Sometimes there's those people that don't wash their hands after going to the bathroom.
Right,
or
right.
Overall, just gross things like that in general.
Makes sense.
Thinking something like that might be.
Yeah.
But no. Okay.
A handshake.
That's interesting.
This is about as strange to me as banning shoulders. So
banning shoulders? What do you mean?
Yeah, I went to a school where if you had
exposed
any
shoulders,
kind of even your
you
side, they had to
you
have sleeves.
Have shoulders and shoulders still encouraged.
You can't ban physically ban shoulders.
Right.
But the sleeves, you had to have at least short sleeves. If it wasn't, you were sent home.
Yeah, that's not fair.
So no showing off of the guns.
Yes, exactly. David, we'd miss your guns. I mean, he comes in every day in a tank top here in the newsroom and just shows off. And he's flexing right now on the camera. Go to WGNRadio.com to see it on the live stream.
Please don't.
So, David, you mentioned you know, smoking at the desk, and I'm a hugger. I hug a lot of people or pats on the shoulder. Can you imagine an environment with no handshakes?
It would be interesting, but frankly, it's an a huge overreaction.
And also pretty unenforceable. I mean, what are they going to do? I think it's maybe there to cover HR's butts, that if someone does something, they say, hey, that rule's there. You're not supposed to touch anyone. And then they can kind of claim no liability in that matter. Because what they're trying to avoid are the lawsuits.
Right. So if a fist fight ever breaks out in the workplace, oh, no, we're not going to try to break it up because HR said we can't touch anybody.
You can't touch anybody.
Right. See how well that works out.
Yeah, exactly. 312-91-7200. Here's another one I'll go. This one is not location specific for finishing the headlines. It's actually kind of a listicle, but I found this interesting. Can you get... Yes. So, you know, you go to weddings. Everyone's been to many weddings out there. Mm-hmm. Some folks might be at one right now. Let us know.
Or
on their way to one. Well, that would be a late wedding, Curtis Koch,
well,
at 9:25.
Or they're coming
Do you even
home
know
from
what
one?
Time it is? Yeah.
No, it's all merged together at one point.
Exactly. you know, because obviously, you know, the statistics are there that, you know, maybe 45% of couples that get married won't last. There is one person in particular at a wedding who is better spotting a couple that's going to end up divorced than any other person at a wedding. So not the bride or groom, but someone else. Studies have shown that there's one person particularly able to determine if the couple is going to end up together or not. It's a specific person at a wedding, if that makes sense.
Is it the groomsman?
It's not the best man.
Best friend, no?
No, it's not. Okay. It's not a groomsman.
Maid of honor?
Not the maid of honor, no. But they've signed that it's one person that would know exactly why.
And the officiant?
Not the officiant. I think that's a good guess, but I think officiants are optimistic, maybe, and they're friends with the people. Yeah. You're kind of always washed up in the love of it all.
And Have you ever been your best man?
Not your best man. Have you ever been to a wedding where you're like, this ain't gonna happen? I've been to a wedding where I knew they wouldn't last, so I got a real bad gift because I was just like, I'm not spending this because we're gonna have a second one in about 2 or 3 years, guaranteed. Are you more optimistic than that, Curtis? You never been to a...
No, well, I was just thinking, you know, when my parents first got married, nobody said that they were going to last, but 27 years later...
Really?
They're still going, yeah. Uh-huh. Like, a lot of people on my dad's side didn't really think
that. How did you come to find this? Just what they told you? Or did they come to you and say...
No.
I can't even believe your parents are still doing it.
My parents joke about it because their friends, I guess, their best friends actually made bets at their wedding, I guess.
At the wedding?
Yeah, at the wedding, yeah. And so my parents obviously are still together, so...
Right. So there's someone waiting to collect on those bets still, I imagine.
My parents?
Yes.
Waiting to collect on those bets, yeah.
Ro, I don't know if you were... Yeah, I know you're handling the callers, but can you guess the one person at a wedding that knows whether a couple's going to divorce or not?
Grandma.
Oh, that's a good guess.
That's a good guess, too.
Right, the age, you know,
yeah.
You think you've been through the experience, you've seen it before. It's not the grandma.
Is it the DJ?
No, DJ. It's not the DJ.
You could tell by the love song.
But you're going in a direction, and the love song actually plays a part of it, too.
The band.
Not the band, but someone that it's not part of the family. I will say that.
Caterer.
Not the caterer, but you're in the right track. Someone that has experience at weddings, that sees a lot
planner.
Of weddings.
Like
the wedding planner.
Not the planner.
Like the serving staff?
Not the serving staff. Just think about this person has an interesting lens in which they see weddings. That was
a
big clue. No, a lens in which they see weddings.
The cameraman?
Yes, the photographer.
Oh,
the photographers at weddings.
Yeah.
They've taken recent surveys. They say that the photographers are the best people to spot when a wedding, because they're looking so intimately at it.
Yeah,
and they see all parts of the wedding. So a lot of times they're at the ceremony, so they're able to see the vows, hear the vows. And they go to so many weddings. Some photographers do 2 weddings a weekend, every single weekend. That's what they do. So they look at the cake in the face ritual. They say the cake cutting, one of the biggest signs if couples will last. Some people like to jokingly smear the cake everywhere. Some people don't, but usually the couple is in sync about it. So if one of them forces it on the others, they know that marriage most likely might end up in divorce. They know the music, eyes on the prize, they call it. The groom not looking into the woman's eyes longingly. And they can see that. You know, they have that really close-up look of everything that's happening. Just other bad omens which happen, of course. And they're also obviously at the ceremony, too. So, like I said, the vows and sort of things like that. But that was interesting. That came from, I don't know how worthy of a source is. It's called doyouremember.com. So don't quote me on that story for sure. But no, the photographer. They also capture all those awkward moments.
Yeah, I would believe that.
And also photographers, sometimes they use the same wedding photographer as they did for the engagement photos. So they see them at different parts in their relationship and see how they progress. So ask your photographer after your wedding if you think we're going to make it. And that they'll be the ones to prognosticate that the most. 312-981-7200. Feel free to join the conversation. Curtis, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks
we appreciate it. All right, go get some fresh air, okay?
I'll try to.
For your sake and for mine, too, okay? All right, 312-981-7200. Join the conversation if you'd like. Coming up after the break, we're going to be talking about the United Methodist Church. We're taking quite a different turn. We're going to be chatting with a Tribune reporter about a possible split in the church over their stances on the LGBTQ plus sort of situation, and not only amongst their parishioners, but also amongst the bishops and the other staff members in the church as well. And then we're going to have Mike Jansen on talking about how unusual... Hey, I'm looking at him on Channel 9 right now. He's going to be coming on in just a little bit to chat about how historic this winter storm is that we're having. But it is 9:30, which means it's news time. We go to the newsroom. Here's David Jennings. 720 WGN and a happy Saturday evening to you. 9:34. On WGN, I'm John Hanson, in for David Hoekstra until 11 o'clock this evening. And on a Saturday night, especially last minute filling in here, I always appreciate anyone that's able to join us, especially reporters. I mean, it's their weekend. They get to enjoy time with their family, their friends, and then I make them come on the air and talk about the stories they've written throughout the week. And Alyssa Cherney, I think I interrupted a birthday party of yours, Alyssa. I'm sorry. Alyssa, you there? There you go. Alyssa, you on the line now here. Did I interrupt your birthday party, Alyssa? Oh, it looks like we lost Alyssa there on the line. Yeah, we're going to try and get her on here in just a little bit. She wrote a fascinating story about the LGBTQ issues that are striking the United Methodist Church. They are reaching a breaking point right now, and she's going to break down exactly what's going on with this situation here on the line. We're actually going to take a quick commercial break, and then I'm going to get Alyssa back on the line here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. I think, fingers crossed, we're joined by Alyssa Cherney. Alyssa, are you there right now?
I'm here. Hi. Sorry
to interrupt your birthday party you're at attending. I was just talking about reporters coming on with me on a Saturday night. Thank you so much for spending some time with us here on WGN.
Oh, yeah. Happy to talk about this very important issue.
Yeah, you know, it's something that has reached kind of it's been a slow simmering issue for many years in the United Methodist Church. And you say in the headline, it's reaching a breaking point. Can you kind of walk us through I know it's a long history with the United Methodist Church and their issue with LGBTQ people. What breaking point are we reaching now with the church?
Sure. So essentially what we're seeing is a deepening divide between some of the more progressive, possibly centrist members of the denomination and some of the more traditional and conservative members of the denomination over longstanding rules in the church about LGBTQ inclusion. So the two issues at play here are whether or not clergy members can perform same-sex marriages and whether or not somebody who is LGBTQ can be a clergy member. And what happened recently is a narrow majority of the United Methodists voted to strengthen those restrictions. And that left many people in the denomination feeling like it didn't represent their values or beliefs anymore.
So were they on a national level? I mean, were some of these laws, or I should say laws, like rules in place, the guidelines that the church likes to follow in place, but just not enforced?
Yeah, that's right. They've been on the books since 1972. There's language in the denomination's constitution, so to speak. It's called the Book of Discipline that, you know, lays this out. But essentially what has happened is that many churches have operated on a local basis, had their own discretion to decide these things, and there wasn't always discipline meted out by the bishops or the other disciplinary apparatuses. And so what this new change really does is it makes sure that anybody who is performing a same-sex marriage who's a clergy member, or if there's a clergy member who is in a same-sex relationship or married to somebody of the same gender, they would face discipline.
Why is it coming to a head now? I mean, what has there been strife amongst the church knowing that there's been these local churches that have allowed it and been okay with it? Why couldn't that status quo have just continued on?
That's a good question, and that was actually something the church was deciding. This all came to a head in February. The church's global delegates met for there. It was actually a special session specifically to deal with this issue. And there were there's actually about three plans, but the two major options were to go this route, to go the more strict traditional route, or to finally formalize this plan that allowed churches to operate with their own discretion. And so a narrow majority chose this plan that will enforce the rules that have actually been on the books for a long time.
You know, this is interesting because, like, I'm trying to compare it a little bit to how on a federal level, and this is obviously a way different scenario, but just to kind of conceptualize it, on a federal level, marijuana is still a class one narcotic, that is punishable in many different ways. On local level, states have obviously chosen different routes, but the federal government theoretically at any point could come in and stop that sort of thing. That's obviously a legal thing, and states can't just leave the union. I mean, they've tried in the long ago, but, you know, so they're kind of bound to the federal government. Are some of these individual churches, when you talk about the split, I mean, would they just break away and start their own thing, do their own thing? Or maybe all the liberal, I would say liberal or more progressive churches unite and form a new religion? I mean, I don't know what the steps are moving forward, the options for them.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to conceptualize. And I think that's what a lot of the church members and clergy members are thinking through. I think the process for them to withdraw from the denomination or to dissociate from it is really a long one. It takes a lot of time. They have to deal with lots of issues like church property and monetary payments. And so that will take a while. But what could happen is, you might see these more progressive groups within the church come together and form their own strand, so to speak, or strain of Methodism, of United Methodism. And this is something these churches are actively talking about. There's actually a conference coming up next month that will bring together 600 leaders in the church to talk about this very issue. But in terms of when that would actually happen or what it would look like, it's hard to say right now.
Yeah, you kind of alluded to this because, you know, I don't know what ties churches to, I guess, the we call it the mothership, the idea of the name of the church and the leaders over on a national or on a world stage. You mentioned financially, I mean, I guess in terms of property, do local churches, do the congregations themselves not own the property? Does the church as a whole, the broader church own it? I imagine each one is different circumstances wise. Yeah, there's probably just a lot of red tape they got to get through if they're going to disassociate with the larger church.
Yeah, and that's it's a very complicated issue, but in the most recent rules that passed on these stricter provisions, there was also a segment about how churches would withdraw if they wanted to over this issue. And so they dealt with some of that. But essentially, technically, the church building the property would, my understanding is that it would belong to the larger structure. And so for this to happen, there needs to be a number of votes, you know, per congregation, and then that's brought up to the larger denomination.
Yeah, I know a lot of people out there might be saying, oh, well, just go by the larger church rules and, you know, maybe, fib a little bit on the local rules or see if you can keep the status quo going. But, you know, for a lot of communities that are in more progressive areas, I would imagine 90, I don't want to even put a number on it, but a large percentage of the congregation are progressive. And then I imagine that in some of the more conservative areas, a large percent of are more conservative. So this is it's really hard to have individual churches following a larger church doctrine when politically we are at church, we're just as divided church to church as we are state to state here in the country.
Yeah, well, one thing I talked to somebody in my article goes by Essie Brick. This person is transgender and they use the pronouns they and them. Mm-hmm. So that if you hear me referring to them like that, that's why. They expressed to me that it's confusing when legally somebody can get married to whoever they want, same sex or not. And then in the church, right, there's these restrictions. And so I think in some ways people are struggling with how the church is catching up or not catching up with the law, across the country. And the other thing to remember is that this is actually a global church. Mm-hmm. So, what's legalized here, what might have become more accepted here over time is not necessarily the case in other places where the church is. It's a denomination of 12.5 million people, and it has a very wide reach. So, people have different norms and standards and beliefs. And so I think this is just something the church as a whole has been struggling with for a long time.
Some of the people in your article have almost been like, on both sides, well, let's favor a split and, you know, best of luck to that other side. Almost like there could be some room for an amicable split that this just isn't going to work. And we're talking about when you talk about LGBTQ issues, I mean, on one side, people say, I'm not bending. I think it's very people don't want to bend on this sort of issue. They are in their camps. Is there a way that, you know, maybe they can reach better agreements and maybe there is a more amicable solution for an easier split on both sides?
It's possible. Again, it's hard to kind of conceptualize what that would look like. People have told me that there's, you know, a possibility where you might have two kind of different tracks of United Methodism within the same denomination. But people on both sides of the debate feel so strongly about this. It's hard to envision that. And this is what, you know, some very prominent pastors have told me. They are among the first to say, you know what, I don't know if we can move forward and be united. People, like you say, are feel very strongly about this. As one pastor put it to me, it's not an issue about an opinion. It's about people's beliefs. And so that's why it's so difficult for people.
Yeah, and for so many people, their church is more than just a place, a building they go to one day a week. It's a community. And this is, I mean, this is a really tough issue to tackle within a congregation.
Yeah, and it's been painful for people. You know, I've talked to folks who kind of describe this as watching parents get divorced, or, you know, it's like going to a family reunion for years and years and then being told you're not invited anymore. So this thing, people are taking it very personally. It's very difficult to watch. And I think that for those who follow, you know, this faith, it's been a really tough process to witness.
Yeah, and I imagine this will be something that is going to be playing out. I mean, this isn't something that is playing out just here in 2019. I imagine this will be a story how this church grapples with this over the coming years.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of these nascent ideas of how the church might move forward will surely be coming to fruition. We'll just kind of have to wait and see what that looks like.
Alyssa, thanks so much for spending part of your Saturday night with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Alyssa Cherney of the Chicago Tribune. And we're going to change subjects and have some more interesting topics along the way after this on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, John Hansen in for David Hoekstra on the Nocturnal Journal for another hour and 12 minutes or so. 9:48 on this snowy Saturday evening here in Chicago. Quite a strange weather day. And in just a little bit, we're going to have Tony Abruscato from everything. He's done the Chicago Flower and Garden Show, working with a new place called City Grange and a great new program called United We Blossom. And he'll be in just a little bit to tell us if we should be worried about our plants. What about those tulips? I just saw Barry Butler post a photo, famed Chicago photographer Barry Butler, on his Twitter page of the famed tulips on Michigan Avenue, just covered in snow, and people worried about whether they're going to make it. So Tony's going to answer those questions. And also answering the question on just how strange this storm is will be Mike Jansen. After he gets off the news on the big old Channel 9, he's going to jump on with us a little bit after the 10 o'clock news with David Jennings, just to kind of put this a little bit into context. Okay, Rose, I'm actually going to go get Tony right now, so we're going to have Tony on in just a little bit. But I wanted to share, I have a couple interesting stories to share with you. Sometimes I do this segment called, I like to call it Today I Learned or Today We Learned. It's also a subreddit on Reddit. I don't know if a lot of you guys use Reddit, but it's a webpage that deems itself the front page of the internet. It's essentially where everyone can post interesting articles, and you can vote them up or down, and you can have them into subcategories. But there's one called Today I Learned, and that's where I find a lot of the stories that I find from there. But I wanted to talk about one story that I had no idea was a thing, and it's this comes from the Smithsonian Magazine. A story called A Brief History of Children Sent Through the Mail. And I had never heard of this, and there's good reason. It didn't happen for very long. Started as a little bit of a joke, but ended up becoming a thing in rural America. So this is going back to the early parts of the 20th century, and the article goes on to say that in one of the most overlooked yet most significant innovations of the early 20th century was the post office's decision to start shipping large parcels and packages through the mail. We kind of take that for granted now. You can send whatever you want, whether it's through FedEx or through the post office itself, but before the early parts of the 20th century, you couldn't send big goods or services in personal mail. So private delivery companies obviously flourished during this century, but the parcel post dramatically expanded its reach of mail order companies to America's mainly rural communities, as well as the demand for their products. So when the post office's parcel post officially began on January 1st, 1913, the new service suddenly allowed millions of Americans great access to all kinds of goods and services. But there were some unintended consequences as parents tried to send children through the mail. Yes, you heard me right. People used to mail babies in the mail. So there's headlines that they show this in through the New York Times. They wouldn't package them in a box and tape it all up or anything. They would be in a little satchel, and the mailman would carry them or take them along with wherever they needed to go. At first, the parcel limit was 11 pounds. So sort of as a joke, as a novelty, one parent sent their child to their grandparents just a couple blocks away through the post office, and the news covered it as if it was this, you know, cute thing. But shortly after that, more and more couples started sending their kids in the mail.
Tell me you're kidding.
I'm not kidding. This is not a joke. This is not a finish the headlines quirky story that has a punchline to it. But an Ohio couple named Jesse and Mathilda Beagle, quote-unquote, mailed their 8-month-old son, James, to his grandmother, who lived just a few miles away in Batavia. According to him, he was the postman. They were just shy of 11 pounds, which was that weight limit. Cost his parents only 15 cents in postage. They did insure him for $50. So the quirky story made newspapers, and for several years, similar stories would surface. Parents kind of following suit. Stories of children being mailed through rural routes would crop up as people pushed the limits on what could be sent through parcel posts. In one famous case, on February 19th, 1914, a 4-year-old girl named Charlotte May was mailed via train from her home in Idaho to her grandparents' house 73 miles away. This was in the National Postal Museum. Her story became so legendary, it was even made into a children's book. Postage, they say, was cheaper than a train ticket, so you would ship your child. Over the years, these stories popped up from time to time as parents occasionally managed to slip their children through the mail thanks to rural workers that were just kind of willing to let it slide. Finally, on June 14, 1913, several newspapers, including the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the LA Times, all ran stories stating that the postmaster had officially decreed that children could no longer be sent through the mail. But while this announcement seems to have stemmed the trickle of tots traveling via post, the story wasn't all done, because a few more parents tried to do it until the post office finally said, you cannot do this anymore, shipping children through the mail. That was 1915 by the time it was all said and done. This all at the Smithsonian Magazine, a pretty legitimate news source, and they have actual clippings in the New York Times of these stories in there. So it's true. I think it's a great way to send kids along. I mean, you're not going to put them in a box. They're just, you know, in a little satchel. And if the mailman can carry them, they'd move it on. I think it's kind of cute.
Uh-huh.
So there you know. There you go. Something you didn't know. Ro, I bet you didn't know that.
I didn't. I'm not sure I agree with it.
But... Well, right. I know. I mean, of course, at the end of the day, no. I mean, if you give them a treat, maybe, then you could put them in a box. Poke a few holes in the thing so it can breathe. He or she can breathe.
I have a question, though.
Yeah, go ahead.
So if somebody... If a worker kidnaps a child, whose fault is it?
Oh, good question. I don't know. Man, you're taking a dark 21st century dark.
I mean, that's my first
thought. This is rural America in the 20th, in the early 19-teens. This is an age of innocence, Ro. No one's kidnapping the children.
Sure.
Yeah. It's just a fascinating story I found on Smithsonian Magazine. Thought I'd share it with you all. Hey, Tony, how are our plants doing here?
We're doing all right. I mean, I saw you Thursday, and we thought it was cold then.
Yeah, so we were at City Grange up at 5520. What's the address?
5500.
5500 Northwestern Avenue. And Tony Oberscott, I don't even know how to refer to you as the greenest thumb in all of Chicagoland.
Well, you know, I kind of adopted the title Mr. Green Chicago.
I like that. And that's your Instagram as well.
It is.
Yeah. Mr. Green Chicago. Man, we're not feeling it today, are we?
No.
Does it make you nervous when you see this snowfall and these cool temperatures come?
You know what? A little bit, but it's Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And we always tell everyone, you know, you start to get these nice couple of days and things, and people go, oh, I'm going to go out and I'm going to, you know, plant my hydrangeas and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. But Chicago and in our zone, you know, Mother's Day.
Mm-hmm.
You wait till
Mother's
Day.
They always wait till Mother's Day.
You wait till Mother's
for
Day.
For things like this.
Oh, absolutely. Because this happens. It's funny, though. A friend of mine owns an Italian restaurant, and he sent me a picture today of me 3 years ago sitting out on their outdoor patio drinking a glass of wine because it was so bright and sunny and mm-hmm. we were doing all these things. And it's like, well, not today.
Well, my brother, younger brother Drew, bought his new boat this exact day last year, and we were on the Illinois River
at
about 82 degrees 1 year ago today. But again, you say that. This is Chicago, and whether it's a historic snowfall like we're getting, and Mike Jansen's going to break it down in just a little bit for it, but I mean, we get these cold spells. I mean, that's nothing unusual. Getting down to below freezing, even in late April, even in early May,
right.
Certainly not out of the question.
No, not at all. And, you know, and so we have to plan for it, and there's things that you can do, you know, especially if there's plants outside already, you know, cover up. I've seen people put, you know, some blankets or sheets
right.
over to keep it there. The one thing I noticed as I was coming here, and I brought you a little treat.
Ooh.
Everyone can't see the little bag that I brought, but since it was so late, I told you I was trying to behave and not have too many martinis.
Yes, I interrupted your dinner, the reporter's birthday party. I'm really just changing everyone's plans tonight.
Yeah, so I was over at one of my favorites, Gina and Giorgetti's.
Uh-huh.
And so I brought you cannolis and tiramisu for you and Ro to have as a little dessert.
Oh, that's awfully kind.
Hugo, my favorite bartender over there, set us up. He's like, what are you going to do? He's like,
where are you going?
Now?
Yes.
He's like, I wonder you're not drinking that much.
So, you know, Barry Butler, I don't know if you know the photographer in town that posts so many great photos of our city. He was jumping around Chicago taking photos this morning. We had a great, gorgeous sunrise. Wasn't very warm, but he showed those tulips that come up on Michigan Avenue.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of covered in snow. Can something like this do damage to the plant, either stunt it or kill it entirely?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I had, when we were out at City Grange on Thursday, I had pulled one. I'm infatuated right now with these scented geraniums.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had one that's lilac scented, and I took home one that was citronella scented. And so I pulled it in off of my balcony just for that reason. But yeah, this could definitely do major damage. You know, I have some friends that work with the city of Holland in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the Tulip Festival starting next weekend.
Right.
And so they actually, if you go to their site, they put these little scarves because I think it was last weekend or just before it had snowed. They had gotten 4 to 6 inches of snow, and they had overnighted from Holland these little scarves. And they showed these pictures that they were wrapping the scarf around the bud overnight so that it would stay, because otherwise it would just kill everything.
So if someone's listening right now, I don't imagine anyone wants to go out right now at 10 o'clock if they're listening at home. But is there something they should be covering if they've got a blanket or something to cover something with?
You know,
is it too late now that we've already had the cold and some of the snow?
I would say for the most part, they'd have to cover if they planted too early.
Okay.
So, you know, right now your shrubs are out there and your trees and maybe
your perennials are fine.
Right.
They know what they're doing.
Perennials are fine and they're coming into season, and you know, maybe your tulips are up, and maybe you've got, you know, we saw some beautiful daffodils and hyacinths and things, and so you can try to protect those and do it. But for the most part, unless you went out and planted your hydrangeas, you're in pretty good shape. And the thing that I noticed is that the temperature really didn't drop below freezing.
Yeah, it stayed just above it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it was pretty decent from that standpoint, where it wasn't cold where it was freezing. But yeah, it, you know, again, it's one of those things where you get nervous.
Tony, I'm going to eat some of your tiramisu that you brought in. We got to take a break for the news, and Mike Jantz is going to come in. You can hang out with us for a little bit, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. And also, if you got your questions for Tony, anything, whether it's about this cold spell or any other questions you might have, Green Thumb related, get those questions in right now. 312-981-7200. 720 WGN. Happy Saturday, everyone. John Hansen filling in for David here on the Nocturnal Journal till 11 o'clock. Tony, this cannoli is incredible, by the way.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Oh, it's really good. It's about halfway done. I just started eating it. Tony's going to take some of your questions regarding plants and all that stuff in just a little bit, but I'm really happy to be joined by one of my favorite meteorologists in town for good old Channel 9. You know, I watch Morgan in the mornings. Of course, we got Tommy Skilling, who comes on all the time, but Mike Jantzen, you have the best voice of any meteorologist in town.
Well, now you put me on the spot. So if I would have jumped on and had a high squeaky voice just to play with,
yeah, I would have turned you off, Mike. I would have been like, "Well, he showed me up. I gotta get this guy off." Mike, I was just watching you on Good Old Number 9. I hope you're getting ready to enjoy your Saturday night. But can you just walk us through how? I mean, it is unusual. We're not mistaken, right? We know we get cold here, but this is this amount of snow that we're going to be getting. I guess first walk through maybe some of the accumulations that we've gotten and just how unusual that is.
Well, I can tell you last check. Now, we haven't had another update from O'Hare since just after 7 o'clock this evening. But at that point in time, O'Hare was reporting 1.9 inches, which would set the record for a single day snowfall this late in the season. I say single day because on May 1st and 2nd of 1940, Chicago officially picked up 2.2 inches. Now, again, that was 3 hours ago,
mm-hmm.
and it's been snowing since then. So I think there's a very good chance that what we've seen today will go down as the highest snowfall total we've ever seen in Chicago this late in the season.
I mean,
it just doesn't happen.
Yeah, and, you know, it's so unusual to come, and, well, I mean, I guess you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but, I mean, we just, less than 2 weeks ago, that Sunday snow that we had two weekends ago, to have both of these, I mean, imagine we're going to be maybe breaking some records for April in general.
Oh, yeah, if you look back, I mean, just what we've seen today snowfall-wise at O'Hare was more than what we saw in the month of December at O'Hare.
Wow.
I mean, that's all you – I mean, and really what we've seen so far in April is more than what you had at O'Hare in December and March combined.
Wow.
So it's just amazing what we've seen. And, you know, some of the reports that I had come into our desk was over 4 inches in a few spots in Kane County. It seemed like Kane County was one of the areas that really picked up a good amount of snowfall. Now, mind you, you get over closer to Rockford, and totals that were being reported over there were over 5 inches. So it's been just an amazing day, and like you're absolutely right. To see two systems like this in 2 weeks' time, and we go back 2 weeks ago, and it snowed over 5 inches at O'Hare, and we thought, oh, my goodness, you know, you really was shocking to see something like that in the middle of April. Then you leapfrog to late April, and here we are probably getting over 2 inches today. And I will tell you, a lot of these villages, they put the snowplows away.
Yeah.
They put away some of that equipment.
Oh, yeah.
And so while IDOT it can get out and maybe attack the interstates, some of these smaller communities, they've probably put the plows away and they've gotten out maybe the lawn equipment. Because yeah. I mowed my lawn yesterday. I put down grass seed yesterday because there were some spots that I needed to as well. I don't have to worry about watering it because it's got plenty of water just from the snow that's going to melt.
I got to say, there's no better microcosm than Chicago weather than what you just said, that you mowed your lawn yesterday, and today we're talking about record-breaking snowfall. Mike, I just want one thing from you. I want your personal guarantee that we're done.
I can't do that. You know, I can't. It would just be two weeks ago. We, you know, everybody said, and I say everybody, boy, it looks like this could possibly be the last win of the season.
Mm-hmm.
And you turn around, and this system, for instance, today, Tamon Bradley asked me at 5 o'clock, how did this happen? This particular system basically ran itself. It fed itself with dynamic cooling. And once we started getting the rain in here, we watched it pull those temperatures down. We started to actually cool those temperatures because we had precipitation falling.
Interesting.
And we watched those temperatures drop. And so you went from 49 was the high today. Well, that came, you know, way early in the morning. And then we started to snow and it started, you know, started to rain. And then those temperatures quickly dropped. I mean, I think in the northern suburbs, I was in Evanston earlier on this morning, and it started snowing there at about 10:15, and with a half hour over in the Glenview-Morton Grove area, we were already starting to mix in the snowflakes. And it was that quick that you saw that changeover. And to have, you know, something like this, when we couldn't get it in December, we didn't have a white Christmas.
Right, right.
But we have a white April 27th.
Yes. So, whatever holiday we want to pick, I'm sure we can find one on the calendar.
Well, you know, my colleague Bill Snyder in the weather office, he said, I'm not considering this to be April 27th. I look at this as being January 117th or whatever it was.
Fifth winter or whatever it might be. At least 2 weeks ago, we could blame it as like a Game of Thrones promotion because it was the start of season
right.
8 that night. Now we got nothing here. Mike, I wanted to ask one other quick question. I imagine, you know, I saw the snowflakes at my place up in Lakeview, I don't know, pretty earlier than I thought they'd be, 11 or 11:30, at least it was kind of a slushy mix. But we at least have a warmer, I mean, the ground having been warmed by, you know, the last couple of weeks, not that we've had exceptionally warm temperatures, but we've had some there, especially last weekend, Easter weekend was great. Mm-hmm. Does that contribute to at least not quick accumulations? Does the ground, does some thermal warmth provide us at least a little buffer there for an hour or two?
It certainly does. I mean, you know, if this, again, like it was 2 weeks ago, I know people that watch, you know, myself on air, any of the on-air meteorologists, or maybe they just track the National Weather Service and say, oh, well, you know, these numbers that we were maybe predicting were, some were saying that we predicted maybe that some of them were too high or whatever it may be. It is tough to predict accumulating snowfall in January when it's the middle of winter and the conditions are what you normally would see when you're talking about a snowfall event. Once you get to this time of year, there are so many variables out there that will change things. I mean, yes, yesterday it was 65 degrees. And with that bright sunshine, yes, the pavements certainly did warm up. Now, mind you, it hasn't been as bad today as what it was 2 weeks ago.
Right.
2 weeks ago when we had that event, yes, we had warmer pavement, but the snowfall rates were getting upwards of close to 2 inches per hour.
Yeah.
And once you started doing that, it didn't matter how warm the pavement had been. It cooled it off. Now, I will say right now, while the roads are looking good, sidewalks and driveways are covered in snowfall. You know, they haven't been treated or anything like that because I took my snow or my salt spreader and put it back in the back of the garage as well. So the good news is this is going to be here today. Tomorrow we'll watch it disappear again.
Yeah.
And you'll have your green yard back. But, yeah, there's so many factors this time of year that you have to look at and say, okay, how much snow are we going to see? Where will it accumulate? How quickly could it accumulate? And there have been spots where visibilities have dropped down because of how hard it was snowing. And the flakes were some of the flakes today seem like the biggest flakes we've seen all year.
Yeah.
I mean, just since it started snowing back in 2018, you know, I mean, it's been amazing and super duper wet too. I mean, we're borderline a raindrop when this stuff comes falling to the ground.
Yeah, it really is incredible to see them, how big they are, how wet and sloshy of the snowfall it is. Mike, I could talk to you about this stuff all night long, but I'm going to let you go and enjoy your Saturday. Thanks so much for stopping by. By the way, not excited about potholes, but I'm watching your colleague Pat Tomasulo fill some with Jarnera right now. So maybe that's a solution for all of us to do it. He's really a man of the people there.
He really is. I appreciate it, guys. Have a good night.
Mike, thanks so much. Tony, before we go to break here, you know, Mike mentioned, don't worry, tomorrow your lawns will be green. I have faith in that. Grass knows what it's doing, I guess you could say. But we do have a question from someone before we take this break here from the 630. They're on their way home right now. He or she says they're willing to go out if it will help their tulips. What should I use? What about pansies in a flower pot?
Well, you know what? One of the things you can use to cover them up, even is like a thin plastic drop cloth that you can, you know, run to your local store and get I've seen people do blankets or plastic sheets around them. Try to put some stakes so that the plastic isn't just laying, you know, doesn't do
flattening
much good
them out.
It's just laying on top of the flowers
them, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you've got if snow's accumulating, it's just pushing them down. So mm-hmm. some stakes, almost like tenting them, you know, with some plastic or some sheets. The one thing we talked about is that, you know, we're not getting to the bitterly cold. So we're staying, it's 34 degrees, it's 40 degrees in that range. And, you know, and some of the plants can hold tight
right
with that. When it really stops, if it's starting to get, you know, 28 degrees, 27 degrees, you have to really kind of get some concern there.
Does weather like this, whether it's snow, the cold, although not, you know, historically cold, I mean, we're still, you know, at or above freezing. What will it do to, I mean, obviously it could kill a plant, but could you see other signs, like maybe it doesn't bloom as much or it doesn't get as big, or is that not weather dependent? Like, could something like this now, we see effects of it in a month from now on how our flowers are performing?
And we've seen it in the past where it got really cold. So, you know, you think about it, the plants are coming out of dormancy. The trees are coming out of dormancy. And so, you know, in a sense, the juices are flowing.
Mm-hmm.
And then that temperature drops, you know, below freezing. And so now you've frozen the buds.
Interesting.
And you've frozen, you know, the fluids in there. And so out of that dormancy, it can really damage how much they flower. Or you'll see damage on, you'll see it on the leaves.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see brown on the leaves where they're almost like burned, where the frost is hitting on there. But you can definitely see it. The nice thing is that, you know, again, this isn't a big, you know, spring planting time.
Right.
This is early spring flowers because we, you know, Mother's Day was, you know, 70 degrees or
right.
whatever it was. And as of yesterday, you know, anytime it's above 55, I try to put the top down on my car. So you
get that urge to plant.
I had the top down yesterday, mm-hmm. and then today, you know, you're on the other side of it. But yeah, putting some stakes out, putting some plastic or some sheets over will certainly, you know, help preserve those a little bit longer. But a few years back, we definitely saw some effects when the weather got really cold.
Right.
Is that it was freezing the buds on the tree and you could see them falling off.
Tony Abrascato, the green, I was at the Green Man, Chicago. You can plug yourself after
Mr.
this.
Mr. Green Chicago.
Mr. Green Chicago. More with him after this on 720 WGN. I just put this song on my playlist, girl.
I'm all in your head.
You are in my head. I love that, Ro. 720 WGN, John Hanson here for David until 11 o'clock on the Nocturnal Journal. Joined by Tony Abruscato. And Tony, we got to reconnect this week at City Grange, which is a great, I loved it there. It's the cutest little thing, a former mechanic shop. It looks like that, right on Western and what's the other cross street
then? Catalpa.
Catalpa.
Yeah.
And what a great place. Talk us through your involvement in City Grange.
So, LaManda Joy, who was the founder of Peterson Garden Project, we've talked for years where she always wanted to have that next step in the next stage,
mm-hmm.
and coming in and being really the nation's first education-based garden center. And so,
and what do you mean by education? Because I mean, you go to a lot of gardeners; they'll help you out the garden places. But what do you mean by education based?
So they're really focused on how to teach you about gardening.
Mm-hmm.
So they're bringing in those professionals that are there. They're hosting a lot of classes that are there. Plus the plants that they have, you know, there's packs for like cooking, and you can grab a you know, an organic pack of edible plants and things like that.
So or for drinking, I learned, too.
Yes.
Mints.
For
drinking. A lot of mint.
You know, I always told people, they're like, oh, what do you like? And I said, well, you know, I do mint because I like mojitos. I do basil because I like caprese salads. I'll grow tomatoes, those types of things. But that's where they'll teach you that process. And also, you know, when you were there and we talked about it, is like you didn't see the spring flowers there yet. Now, if you went to maybe one of the big box stores, I haven't been.
That's what they're pushing.
But they have them out there.
Right.
Whereas, you know, they're looking at City Grange and they're going, it's not time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not time yet. Now is kind of the cool crops, if
lettuces.
You will, the lettuces and peppers and different things that are there. So,
you know,
so that's where they're teaching you those aspects of it, so you're successful with it.
I was just going to say, that's the key, is that if you are new to gardening, you're trying to get your green thumb, and you do it wrong and something dies, you get discouraged and you may never do it again.
I hear that over and
yes.
over again.
That's how I started. I know I did planters 1 year out of my first apartment in Chicago. Nothing went right. I probably did everything in the wrong order. And instead of, you know, going back again the next year and trying it or asking, I just stopped for a few years.
Right. And that's, you know, and that's one of the things that impacts the entire industry, because you think, you know, if you do it and everybody else is doing it. And I always talk about gardening being where it is kind of intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to be successful, but you also have to remember, you know, it's a living thing. It's a live plant. It's not a piece of art. And you're like, oh, I didn't paint that right, so I'm going to repaint it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could do everything right. We were talking about this on Thursday. You could do everything right, and that plant still may die. There might be something genetically in it or something else. And so
I had a fig tree. Did everything I could to it. Hardest thing to take care of. Didn't give it the right light, I don't think, but gone. $80. Bye.
Oh yeah, and I, you know, I've been through. One year out of the Flower and Garden Show, I pulled out two big spruces. They were like 12 foot tall blue spruces, and I thought, these are perfect. And I took a Japanese maple. And historically, you know, you think Japanese maple, and they're kind of finicky, and you know, it can be, you know, an issue to get them to be successful and everything. That Japanese maple, 6 years later, is absolutely gorgeous.
It's fine, yeah.
Both spruces died at the end of the
of
the
course,
of the
you never
season.
Know. And you're a professional.
Yeah. And, you know, but that's where, you know, City Grange comes in. And then we got involved because we have, out of the Flower and Garden Show now, we created the Get Growing Foundation, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. And we're focused on taking the message of the Flower and Garden Show and putting it out on a year-round basis and going out into the communities. I mentioned to you on break that we did tree plantings yesterday with People's Gas and MPL Construction. We were at a high school, a middle school, and an elementary school doing that. And then as part of the social enterprise aspect of City Grange, though it's a for-profit company, they wanted to be socially driven. And so we've created a program, we're participating in their program called United We Blossom, where we're taking apprenticeship program, and putting people to teach them how to teach people to grow their own food and work in the industry, because as we noted, 39% of green industry jobs went unfilled last year, leaving $1.9 billion in unearned revenue on the table just in Chicago. That was just in the Chicagoland area. And so there aren't people for the jobs that are available. And so that's part of City Grange, too, is that right now we have 10 people in, associates or apprentices, that are there. And our goal is to continue to expand that, and then not only place them after the 6 months of apprenticeship, place them at City Grange, but then potentially place them throughout the industry.
It's like any industry, or even like building like a college sports franchise. You need a deep bench.
Absolutely.
You need to teach people that are going to be able to teach people. If there's only one or two people in the store, in the shop, in the neighborhood that are experts, we need to get some more institutional knowledge into this. That's going to help the whole industry grow. And you mentioned, I mean, it's not only a great mission to help apprentices get jobs that they maybe wouldn't otherwise have, but it's good for the industry fiscally, economically. It makes more sense.
Absolutely.
Everyone's going to prosper. Everyone will bloom together.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and you know,
and see the green. Sorry, I keep on interrupting you with these terrible puns.
No, it's good. I've got them. You know, next year it's 2020 for the Flower and Garden Show. So, So I'm on this whole focus, a vision.
Yes.
You know, all those things. But what. One of the things that I've been going back to the industry about, especially through the Flower and Garden Show, is that we have to cultivate the next generation of gardener, because the industry was very happy that, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but you know, grandma was the gardener. And so they never looked over their shoulder and said, where is the next gardener coming from? But then also on a business standpoint, where is the next consumer coming from?
Right.
And so now all of a sudden there was this lag in the industry because of a lot of people weren't having success with it. A lot of people weren't growing their own, you know, their own plants and their vegetables and things like that. And now the industry's looking back and going, oh my gosh, where's our
consumers?
Where's our consumer? And even flower and garden shows across the country, they've seen attendances drop because people aren't interested. But now millennials growing their own food, organics.
Yep.
And the big one right now is houseplants. Houseplant sales are up 300%.
Well, that's the interior design now. It's not necessarily the art on the wall. It's the green space in the room. We got to take a quick commercial break, then we'll wrap up with you, Tony, after this on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Happy Saturday evening, everyone. David Hoekstra out tonight with the Nocturnal Journal. John Hansen in instead. That's me until 11 o'clock. And Carl and Lisa are already warming up their voices. They're getting ready for their show, of course, which starts at 11 o'clock every Saturday night. Most times that I'm filling in the middle of the night, I'll talk to Blake Stubbs, my good old buddy and movie critic, simply because, Blake, you're the only one that'll come on with me. Thanks so much for doing it again.
Thank you for having me.
It's just process of elimination.
John.
I'm like, you know, I'll just get Blake in here. You know, why not?
And, you know, as good of friends as we are, and as funny as we are when we talk, and that's me talking about us, we might as well let everybody else in on the gag.
Yes.
So, yeah, I figure it's cool that you invite me on. Thank you. Yeah. No, as always, thank you very much.
Tonight, it's a human hour, you know, an hour where human beings are meant to be awake.
Exactly. Usually, I'll full disclosure, sometimes I take like little naps before we have our oftentimes 2:30, 3:30 in the morning chats, and then I try to go back to sleep, and it just doesn't happen for quite a while.
Yeah, well,
but today, I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some movies.
And I can hear the enthusiasm in your voice, and obviously, hey, before anyone freaks out, there will be no spoilers in this discussion.
No.
None, because I know you would never want to ruin it, and we talked about spoilers last week, but you sent me a long diatribe. I knew I didn't even read it because I knew we'd just talk about it on the air. But you mentioned roller coasters, emotions. You seemed excited. There were some all caps at some point. So Avengers Endgame excited you.
Yes. So, I mean, if you want a very quick spoiler-free review, because this could turn into a huge discussion, I know I want people to go see this movie. I was excited to see this movie. I saw it with a packed house. So, you know, I'm kind of still reeling from that. I'm like, there's a lot to unpack. It is a three-hour film. That is one thing I want everyone to know. The film is 3 hours long. It does not have an intermission. So there were a lot of questions about, well, what if I have to go to the bathroom? If you want to be safe and Google, there are plenty of guides written by multiple websites.
Just bring a Pringles can or something like that. I don't know.
And take a break. So,
yeah.
Did I lose you?
No, I was going to say you should bring I was saying you bring an empty water bottle or a Pringles can or something in there.
Might freak out the people next to you.
That's true. It's packed theater.
But,
yeah,
you know, we live in America, and I'm not about to tell anybody what they can and can't do.
They'll plan it out, and then you're going to love what you see. Sorry to keep interrupting you, Blake, there.
No, you're fine. You will love what you see. I think that if you have invested yourself in, this is the 22nd film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. There was a lot of thought that it would be the end of what is called Phase 3, the third phase of films. That will actually be the next film, which is Spider-Man Far From Home. However, this film is the culmination of a lot of storylines, a lot of high-stakes things within that cinematic universe. A lot of people know that Avengers Infinity War was a very big film with a lot of emotional response from the audience. When I saw it the first time, there were two kids sitting behind me dressed as Spider-Man and Captain America, and they were both crying their eyes out when the movie ended. Now, those are little kids, all right? And when I say little, I'm thinking probably 9, 10 years old. But their whole life, all they've known are these characters. All they've known are these films. And for a lot of other people, older generations, they've wanted to see these characters on a big screen. This is the culmination of 10 years of storytelling in one of the biggest, most epic films with one of the largest casts I've ever seen assembled. And they're all stars. Mainly, if for some, they're stars because of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Others, it's big stars. For example, like Robert Downey Jr. A lot of people know Robert Downey Jr. He's been an actor since he was very young. Immensely talented. And a lot of people would say he was born to play Tony Stark, and I would agree with him. Going into this, you got a lot of baggage. You know, you want to know what's going to happen. It's exciting. It's a big event-type film.
I got to ask you, Blake. So I'm looking at tickets here in Chicago. Obviously, so many of these shows have been sold out. There still are some opportunities now that we're getting to the witching hour. I see that the 12 a.m. is sold out at Block 37. The 12:45 isn't, so that's good news. Same with the 12:45 in Real 3D. I'm looking at the AMC theaters here downtown on Illinois, and there's a couple different viewing options. There's like Real 3D, there's digital, and then there's something called the Dolby Cinema, and that one at 4 a.m. still has a seating. Is there like a best way to see this film? Like, do you recommend? And I mean, should it be on the biggest screen with the best sound possible? Walk us through that.
I would definitely say see this on the largest screen possible. See this with the best sound possible. I, for one, on my purest roots tell me, unless the film was explicitly shot with two cameras in 3D, see it in 2D.
Okay.
Now, that's me. That's my preference. I'm not going to tell anybody to see it one way or another. However, if you are in Chicago and you are trying to pick a screen to see it on, the size of this film, the scale of it, the immense nature of it, because it is, I would call this an epic. I would say see this at the Dolby Theater at AMC River East. Now, I don't work with AMC. I've been in that theater. I know what that experience is like. The sound is exquisite. The screen is immense. I think that it is a perfect venue to see this film.
And guess what? The 4 a.m.'s got some seats available.
So I could hop in the car now and drive up from Peoria and see that at 4 a.m. if you were game. But I will say that I do want to see this film again to add a little bit more credence to what I've said about it already.
Uh-huh.
I very much enjoyed it. Seeing it with a crowd, I will say that the sooner one sees it, the better in terms of the purity of the reaction. Because I was sitting in a packed crowd, and there were moments in this film where I heard a collective crying. I heard a collective cheering. It was like being at a sporting event. So, I mean, a packed, like, I mean, I was there when the Hawks won the Cup in 2015, and that was the United Center, completely packed. This was a smaller movie theater, but the energy was similar. People were really amped to be involved in this, and there are some serious moments for the fans.
Yeah.
That if you have been in on this, then you're ready for it.
I'm blown away. I'm looking at seats tomorrow, and a lot of the showings are already sold out. I mean, there are some that aren't. I haven't even looked in the suburbs yet. I think the theaters are meeting the demand, and obviously they know there's money to be made, and all the sold-out shows, it's great for pub. It's not great for business. They want to get as many butts in the seats as they can. Even the 8 a.m. tomorrow morning has two tickets left at the AMC on Illinois and the Dolby Theater, at least. But I'm saying that if you're thinking that you cannot see the movie this weekend, if you're in the Chicagoland area, you can find a theater that'll play it. Blake, we got to take a quick commercial break. Afterwards, though, I was hoping you could put into context the money that this movie is going to make compared to not only other Marvel movies, but other movies that have had huge blockbuster releases. We can do that after the break, right?
Yes, sir.
Absolutely. All right. After this on 720 WGN.
720 WGN Nocturnal Journal. David Hochstrout tonight. John Hanson in for another 10 minutes before we get to some fine WGN Radio Theater. Carl and Lisa warming up. Hope Lisa just took off her coat. She's getting ready to go. They'll be joining us in just a little bit. On the line with Blake Stubbs, Blockbuster Blake. And, of course, it's a huge weekend with Avengers Endgame out. You had your mini spoiler-free review. Let's put this in context, Blake. How much money is this thing going to make? It's already made a ton.
Well, how much it's going to make is a little hard to predict right now. But where it's at and where it's heading in the short term, I can give you a really good sense of that situation.
Okay, do it, my friend.
So as of this morning, the film domestically was sitting at $156.7 million. Now, that puts it in the category of being the fastest to $100 million, the fastest to $150 million, the largest single-day total, the widest opening of all time. Now, widest meaning it was in more screens, I believe, across the country than any other film in the history of recorded history, I guess, of the box office. And in just Thursday night, when I saw the film, it took in $60 million in the U.S. So that puts it on pace for 3 days to make all over $300 million, potentially in the $345-plus million range, which, by the way, blows away everything else and its predecessor, actually, in the mythos, which is Avengers Infinity War, which I think was somewhere in like the $250 million range, $257 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So if this movie does what they're predicting it's going to be, and as you were just kind of highlighting, screenings are still selling out. They're selling out all over the place. This thing just domestically is looking at being continuing to shatter records and be probably the biggest of all time in terms of its first weekend. And just for a little context of where it's currently sitting worldwide, I believe it's sitting at around $644 million, and that's including international screenings. So within 5 days, this film looks to make $1 billion.
That's incredible.
Immense, yes. Internationally, if you do all the totaling up, I think internationally it was sitting at $487 million, which is the largest opening weekend for a film internationally, and it beat out The Fate of the Furious from 2017, which held the record at $443 million. So every like conceivable record that you're throwing at this movie in the short term for its opening weekend, it's breaking them left and right, and it's hard to say, like, everything I'm telling you right now, by probably noon tomorrow, would have even bigger numbers. And they'll be keeping track of this pretty strict, I mean, over the next few hours. And I've seen numbers where they broke it down by country.
Yeah.
Just know that, like, by and large, a lot of it has to do with how many screens the film gets put on. And I believe this film has been released on more screens than any film ever, not just in the U.S., but I think worldwide.
Oh, this doesn't surprise me. I've seen some theaters where there's Endgame, and then there's like some B-run movie just on one teeny little screen, and that's it for the whole theater.
Correct. And that is not exactly an uncommon practice. There were times back in the era of still seeing midnight screenings, and comic book movies fell into this realm. I remember seeing a couple of Spider-Man films at midnight, and you would go, but like every screen in the theater was playing that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why those movies had the massive returns in the immediate that they were able to pull in. Now, we're sitting in an era where there are more screens, there's more tech, there's more in terms of making the viewing experience more enjoyable. So even though this is a three-hour film, chances of sitting in a theater that isn't comfortable is unlikely these days. Most of these theater chains are really upping their game in terms of comfortable seating, better concession options, closer bathrooms, like all the things that, you know, the Megaplex needed to have if it was ever going to grow into an era where movies like this are going to come out on the regular. And trust me, they are. I mean, Disney is way
yes.
ahead of the game in terms of releasing big franchise films on the regular. And guess what? We're gonna go through this Endgame run here, and then within about a month or month and a half, we're going to have a Spider-Man movie come out.
Oh,
and
gosh.
That'll be big. You know what I mean? I don't think it'll be Endgame big, but it'll be big.
The powers are really concentrated in these big releases because, man, they make some serious money. Hey, I wanted to ask you, Blake, did anyone else even, like, venture to try and open this weekend? Like, I know that the studio's trying not to, you know, compete with the ones that they know are going to be big or they anticipate to be big. Is anyone even coming, like, releasing anything else this weekend?
There were other things, but it's all small
Things they want to hide, maybe.
Well, maybe it's something they want to hide. I'm not too sure. When I looked at stuff that was coming out, I was like, I don't know what any of this is. And
right.
I'm pretty in the know about what's coming. Now, that doesn't mean it's not good.
Right.
that is not the question that I'm answering or the way I'm trying
right,
to answer
right,
this
right,
question.
Right.
It's more a matter of, you know, certain films get distribution deals and they have to release when they say they're going to release. And that has nothing to do with whether Disney's dropping quite possibly the biggest movie of all time,
right?
Which time will tell. Because right now, you know, if you look at the highest grossing films of all time, it's got quite a ways to go to top Avatar,
right?
Which closed worldwide with about $2.8 billion.
It's crazy.
And Titanic, which was $2.2 billion.
Adjusted gross now.
That is, I don't know about adjusted.
I imagine that's got to be adjusted.
In this era, those are all the numbers that you see are probably adjusted for current inflation.
Yeah.
And also, just an interesting little thing, Marvel, in all their releases, of the top 10 highest grossing films of all time, Marvel has 4 of those slots.
Mm.
3 of them are the previous Avengers films. And Black Panther is the other one at number 9.
Wow.
So this film is probably going to boot Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 out of the top 10 for sure, I would wager. Because it's probably going to do that here in the next week if numbers hold. I don't want to say completely unprecedented, but, yeah, there's a lot of things that this movie has done just in the few days it's been out. In the U.S., but not only that, worldwide, because it came out earlier in China and already had, like, I think, $300 million by the time Thursday closed.
Hey, Blake, we're running out of time. I just want to ask you, how many more times are you going to go see this movie in the theater, realistically?
Well, I saw Infinity War 3 times. I will probably see this 3 times. It's big, it's layered, there's a lot to it, and I got to admit, I want to see it once without a crowd. I just want to take it all in.
Well, that won't be for months.
That won't be. No, it won't be, but sooner or later, I'll get out there and I'll see it.
All right, Blake Stubbs, thanks for stopping by. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Have a good one. All right, I got the two greatest people in the studio with me now that I kicked Blake Stubbs off the phone line. Carl and Lisa, how you guys doing?
Hey, John, how are you?
I had to bring you in here to Crosstalk because normally I'm sitting where you are, Carl, and my eyes are barely open. I've woken up from a nap. I'm filling in for Dave Plyer, and I'm like, how are we going to get through these next 3 hours? But now I'm looking at you guys. Now, you guys never have to
worry. That's what Lisa looks like right now.
No.
We are bright and cheery.
You guys are always bright and cheery, and you guys had any problems getting in?
No.
No.
Road's okay?
We carpool, so I have a Jeep with 4-wheel drive.
Oh.
So I pick Lisa up, and the very first thing she says to me is, could you drive slow? It's bad out there.
I said slowly. Yeah, I know how to say it right.
But that she's right, Carl.
Yeah.
I'm like,
sometimes he's
don't
a little
worry
reminder,
about it.
Oh, because you're a Jeep guy.
I got a Jeep.
Do you honk
don't
at other
worry.
Jeep guys or do the wave thing?
Yeah. I do the wave thing. My
That's
son
something.
Thinks I'm
a little
crazy
camaraderie. There.
I try and do it in my Mazda, like a little zoom zoom. No
does
one does
it. Work?
No,
yeah.
no one no. does it with me. They just give me another finger.
There's definitely a camaraderie with the
Jeeps. Which finger are we talking about here?
Well, I can show you, but we're on the live stream too. I'm excited to listen to you guys on my drive home. What do you guys got tonight?
I don't know. What do we have, Lisa?
She's finding it out. She got the blue sheet.
Hour one. No, it's a blue envelope.
Okay.
Hour one, we have Gunsmoke. That's always a favorite. We have Adventures of Maisie, hour two.
Maisie, good comedy.
And we have Michael Shane, hour
detective.
Three.
Detective. So Western comedy and detective.
We know how to mix things up.
Yeah, you're really changing. Yeah. I got to say, I love listening to you guys when I drive in, filling in for Dave Plyer. And Carl, I've told you in the past that I grew up listening to some of the programs you've done.
Great.
And it was just, it was one of the reasons I got into radio. Sort of that old time feel of things and just the storytelling.
Well, we
really
love your
great
show too.